I'm Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
All right, good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, and you progressive utopians with the sense of humor. Thank you for coming out in San Francisco. Good morning, Mark Riley.
Good morning, Mark Maron. How you doing?
Well, you know, I don't even know what time it is anymore. My body clock is so screwed up, man. I mean, I go out to San Francisco on Friday after the show. I do two shows in San Francisco. I can't get to sleep. I was up for 24 hours straight after the shows. I was so manic and jacked up from doing, like, some crazy comedy on Friday night. Had great shows. All these great people came out. Big fans of the show, man. People brought us presents.
Thank you for that.
musical cable car.
My daughter's going to love it.
And Vince, our buddy Vince, who he brought us a Dick Gregory, a Kent State album, and some other stuff. Just a lot of fans for the show. The Quake did a great job out there. I got to thank those people over there, KQKE 960, and also the people from Talk City in Sacramento. That's AM 1240 up there, and SAC came down, and all the fans came down. They did a great job plugging the show, and we had a good time. All the shows were really really fun, really excellent. My wife, Mishna, opened up for me, and Ted Alexandra was the feature act. It was great, man.
Sounds great, but now...
I don't know what time it is.
Let me get the chronology straight here. You did the show on Saturday night.
I did Friday, too.
I know, okay. But Saturday night's important because you lost an hour of sleep on Saturday.
Oh, dude, I don't even know what time it is.
And then you got on a plane and flew back... From the west coast to the east, where you feel like you lose time anyway.
Yeah, I went back to the Cat Poo Palace, which is my house, leaving the three wild animals without any supervision for 3 days. And yeah, I have no idea what time it is. I can't, I don't think about it like that anymore. I just think about hours of sleep.
Let me tell you something. Yeah. I made one of the worst. Never ever change your clock when you're half awake.
Yeah,
because that's what I did. I set it 2 hours ahead instead of an hour ahead. So and fell back asleep.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh,
and then woke up yesterday morning thinking it was an hour later than it actually was. And I'm running around the house. And, oh my God! I'm going.
And then my wife
looks at me and says, "What are you doing?"
Oh,
it's like, what? Look, it's 8 o'clock. No. Well, no, it's actually only 7 o'clock.
Yeah.
No, but I set the clock ahead.
Yeah, I know.
And if you look at your watch, you'll see that it's 2 hours ahead.
And this happened this morning?
Yesterday morning.
Oh, all right. Yesterday morning. Well, as long as it wasn't this morning. Yeah, I'm just a little tweaked. But I'll tell you, man, for some reason, Friday night, if I don't sleep and I do the show, I don't know where the energy comes from, but I blasted through that first show on Friday and it was mind-blowing. I mean, I was surprising myself. I'm not going to toot my own horn, but I know
go
that.
Go ahead, toot your own horn.
But I know that I was out there. You know what I mean? I was, doing a lot of improvising. And it was kind of, my consciousness was, kind of breaking apart. And the second show Friday, same thing. And then I go back to the hotel room and I can't sleep and I'm starting to freak out. Like my wife flew up because that feeling you used to get back in the day when I used to do the drugs. Like when you couldn't sleep, you'd cross this line.
Yeah,
I was up
for
24 hours straight and I'm like, oh man, you just start to think like my entire week's gonna suck and then it's like my entire year's gonna go bad. I might as well die, And then
the walls of the hotel room start sweating because then you really know.
Well, no, I kept I do that thing where I woke up my wife. I'm like, baby, I'm in trouble here, man. And she's like, what? And then and she gets up and she says, I'm sleeping. Why are you doing this? I'm like, because I can't sleep and I'm having a little bit of an anxiety attack. Part is, of course, when you don't sleep for that long because you start to break apart and you try to hold it together. And she gets up here and she gives me those stress mints. You know those mints you see that sell now, like at drugstores? They're called stress mints or supposedly, what's that? Their homeopathic stress remedy. I'm like, then she goes back to bed. I wake up in the morning. I'm like, thanks. That was great. You woke up in the middle of the night and gave me candy. What am I, seven? That's terrific. I really appreciate that.
Hey, man, every coffee shop, it seems, in certainly in the New York area, has one of those. I guess they figure if you're going to get juiced up off of caffeine, you got to have something to bring you down.
Yeah, the stress mints. Kalo, Costco ho, my friend, you feeling all right? You off the Vicodin? Or have you now dipped into the leftovers for recreational purposes, as it always begins that way?
Yeah, the leftovers are at home. Yeah. I have a couple of leftovers.
Can you bring some in?
But, yes, I'm off of the Vicodin.
You're off of the Vicodin.
Yes, and I feel good.
I'm going to keep an eye on you. man.
Thanks,
buddy. I'm going to keep an eye on you because it's those two Vicodin that are sitting in that cabinet. If they start talking
seven.
To you.
Seven.
You got seven Vicodin.
Seven?
Okay. He's counted them. He's counted them twice. That's what's going to happen. It's like, hey, I got a headache a little bit. You know what? I got those Vicodins. I mean, what can you, you know, so if I'm going to stop the pain, why not stop the pain of everything?
Exactly.
I understand. You don't got to tell me. Now, we got to draw a line here, Kayla, because there's this problem here in the studio that needs to be resolved, which is that there's a lot of talk about Sin City, which is this new movie that's based on a comic book, and we have a couple of comic book geeks here. Clutch Larson, you know, lives in comic books. I mean, that's really, that's, you know, when many of us were looking at Playboy, Larson was looking at Batman, and that's just, that's the way he is, you know, that's the way his sexuality was, you know, dealt with at that time.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
But, you know, my relationship with comic books, I have to be honest with you, because I've had one, has always been with underground comics, you know, S. Clay Wilson, Crumb, Spain, Furry Freak Brothers. And then when I did finally read comics, I read later in life, like I was later in life, well, you know, when I was 90. No, but I guess it was the mid-80s, I started reading Hellblazer and Sandman and the Mystical Ones and some of the sort of revolutionary comics. But I was never a Marvel Universe guy. I was never a superhero guy. I read The Watchmen. I dug it. I got into the comic thing. But I didn't get into the old classics because I couldn't go back in time and be seven. All right? So they don't have that effect on me. And now there's all this discussion about Sin City is like whether it was a good movie, whether it honored the comic book, whether, you know, what about comic books and what about these other characters. And I want to stop it, Chris, and I need you to be on my team here. Either we're guys who read comic books or we're the regular guys who enjoy women. Now, what are we going to be?
What are we going to be? Both?
Okay, maybe we can be both. But see, my comic books have always been the mystical kind of weird sort of, you know, not superhero universe thing.
Sin City is exactly like that. You know, there aren't superheroes. There's a ton of nudity. And, you know, it's very good. I think you'll enjoy it. It's very dark, you know?
I guess I'm not looking at nudity. I'm not saying that Jonathan Larson and his ilk don't like women. I guess it's just what it is that I don't have any action figures at home. You understand?
But Sin City has no action figure heroes.
Well,
you know?
I like this guy. He's Frank Miller, right? Is that his name?
Yes, Frank Miller.
And he was the guy. What was his big? He was a Batman guy.
No.
And Dark Knight Returns, right? Which I read the Dark Knight Returns, and when I was in my little comic book mode, and I dug it, but I didn't go, man, I got to read all the Batman now, and I'm gonna get a Batman hat. And but I did start honestly though. Swamp Thing was my guy. That was the most of the classics that I ever read. So moving on, I guess there is no fight to be had here. I just
thought you'd pick one.
Well, I mean. I want to be on your team, Aaron.
No, I like Frank Miller, and I'm going to go see the film. It's just like, I don't want to get sucked back into the world of comic books. You know, I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to go back there, man. You know, I enjoy my free time.
Well, you can do both. You don't have to be sucked back in. Just enjoy.
No, it's got to be black or white. You understand?
Barely. There's no gray area.
There's no gray area.
This guy Miller apparently really had a role in making this movie, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, he wasn't just... You know, the guy that they adapted the stuff from, he actually had a role in it.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty fascinating. I mean, but I think that somebody did that.
He was a co-director, by the way.
Co-director. But yeah, I think Warren Beatty did Dick Tracy years ago, which did sort of a similar thing in honoring the frames of the comic book in terms of colors and in terms of setup. But, you know, it's not like this is like some sort of brand spanking new idea to sort of limit film to comic book standards.
Let's hope.
I kind of wish every comic book movie was like this.
Okay, is that good?
Oh, it was great.
All right,
I really enjoyed it.
All right, I'm gonna go see it.
Yeah, you'll love the style of it. I really think you'll.
I'm sorry. I guess like you know, my brain's just a different place. I went and saw that movie, The Ballad of So and So, and what's her name
with Daniel Day-Lewis
about the ex-commune guy, and I thought that was pretty exciting. It was an interesting movie, but it copped out at the end. There was a couple of moments that were ridiculous.
Really?
Rebecca Miller did it, I think, Arthur Miller's daughter, and apparently she's been working on it a long time. And there's some pretty interesting moments in it. You know, Catherine Keener is genius. The guys who played her kids were great. And, you know, I thought it was a great movie right up until the end when I think she copped out. But I've learned my lesson on radio not to go ahead and discuss that openly.
The Ballad of Jack and Rose.
Jack and Rose. And I'm not going to knock Sin City. I was just trying to pick a fight with the comic book geeks. My problem is I have enough parts of me that have sort of done all the weird things that some people commit their life to that I can't quite, you know, draw a line because they are part of me as well. I just chose not to go too deeply into them to where it retarded me socially. It is the anniversary of the death of Martin Luther King. We are going to come back and talk about that. We're also going to talk about apparently the Pope has passed away. Maybe you didn't hear that. But we will talk about the death of the wizard as well. 15 past the hour, Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition.
The highest rated, most respected news show in America.
On Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Morning Sedition, the facts, the fury, the funny. Morning Sedition, don't be stupid. It feels like thinking, Riley. So today is the anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King.
37 years ago today, Martin Luther King stood on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. He had gone to Memphis to support a group of striking sanitation workers. They had been on strike for some time. They were predominantly African-American, not entirely African-American. And it was part of what Martin Luther King, I think, had started to do late in his life. The year earlier, had taken widespread heat from within the civil rights community for stepping off the ranch and condemning the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was getting into this kind of local activism, which had not always worked well. He had gone, for example, to suburban Chicago to try and help with desegregation battles. Didn't work real well for him. He had tried to do some initiatives here in New York. Didn't work that well for him. But Memphis, the sanitation workers had really been looking for someone to come there and help. And, of course, as he stood on that balcony, a man shot him.
Mm-hmm.
Shot him and killed him. Andrew Young was there. The Reverend Jesse Jackson was there. Ralph David Abernathy, who was from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, was the number two guy in the organization.
Is everybody on the same page with the shooter that it was indeed with James Earl Ray?
James Earl Ray, yeah.
I mean, is there a conspiracy around that? Is there speculation otherwise?
There has always been, in the 37 years since King was assassinated, there has been widespread speculation that James Earl Ray was part of a larger conspiracy. Some people think possibly government. Some people think Klan. Some people think any number of different organizations, but a lot of people do not believe that James Earl Ray acted by himself in assassinating Martin.
I get it. So now, I didn't realize, also, this is, I guess we'll segue into this. I had no idea, and I guess this is just my lack of education, or I'm not sure, but I just found out yesterday, I had no idea that there had been black popes in the history of the papacy.
Yes, and you're not alone. I mean, there are a lot of black people who don't know that there were black
Well, thank
popes.
God. That means I won't get any weird letters.
No, you won't get any weird letters about this. For example, the 15th pope was St. Victor I. Prior to that, there was Miltiades, who was the 32nd pope, and this was during the Miltiades' reign. Emperor Constantine of Rome was converted to Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Saint Gelasius I was the 49th pope, born in Rome of African parents. He was in the 5th century. So there have been a number of them. I'm not exactly sure why they suddenly turned off the spigot.
Well, yeah, I'd say since like the 5th century, I think it's high time we have another black pope. And there are a couple of candidates.
There are candidates. And, of course, with the passing of... And see, this is something that's very interesting to me, Mark.
Yeah.
I've lived through the passing of a couple of popes. Pope John the 23rd and then Pope John Paul, who served a very short period of time.
I'm trying to remember the guy who was before John Paul. That was John the 23rd? He died? Who did he replace? Because I remember when I was young, it was 26 years ago, so I wasn't that young. What was I, 14 or so? I remember mm-hmm. the smoke coming out of the Vatican or waiting to that they picked the pope. I remember when they picked him, but I don't remember the guy before him.
Well, the guy before him was Pope John Paul.
Right.
Who served a very, very short period, if memory serves me correctly.
Yeah.
He was one who really was ill and became ill and died. And then John Paul II came along, and he served essentially for a generation, which means that a lot of young people have never experienced the sequence of events by which a pope passes and a new pope is...
It was like a month. The guy, they picked the guy, and he kicked, and then they had to go to...
And remember, well, no, I shouldn't say remember, because a lot of people don't. John Paul II was considered... not really in the running at the time. I mean, I hate to put it in such crass terms, But that's the way, you know, I mean, people handicap the future pope just like they handicap races in this country.
And I tell you, you know, they've got him laying out in, what do they call that, in state? He's laying
in
state.
Yes, he's lying in state.
And they, you know, Catholics love to just, you know, put the dead people out on display. I have been, you know, I went to, it's unbelievable. I, as a Jew and not a religious person at all, the pine box, covered up, throw it in the ground, that's it. No display, no looking at the body. But I tell you, the Catholics are hung up with the death trip, and that's for sure. The entire religion is based on a death trip, as is most of Christianity. But the thing is when I was in Italy, mm-hmm. I went to a lot of cathedrals, Mark, and in the amount of effort and artistry they put into putting that Catholic trip across is powerful. Everywhere you go into the cathedrals, and they had subcontracted the greatest architects, the greatest artists, the greatest muralists, the greatest everything, and you walk into some of these cathedrals in Siena, in Florence, in Gubbio, anywhere, even the smaller towns have these cathedrals where you walk in, and even if you don't believe, you will look up and go, oh my God, this is mind-blowing.
Let me tell you something. I went to Salvador in Brazil, mm-hmm. which is that's the black state, Bahia is the black state of Brazil. And there's a church in Salvador, which is the capital, called São Francisco. And you go in there, and the first thing they'll tell you is that the entire church was built by slaves, mm-hmm. which made it, you know, it's like, whoa. And then you realize that the walls are covered in gold. I mean, not just like gold plating or gold inlay, gold all over everything.
So let's say you got nothing. All right, you're just a peasant, yep. right? And you're not sure what you believe in. And you walk into this place that have walls of gold, and they go, you want in?
You go, yeah. Why not?
But the Pope laying in state is not unusual, because all of these cathedrals, when you go to anywhere in Italy, there's a dead wizard in a box, or at least a piece of a dead wizard in a box, or some sort of finger or ear or head. St. Catherine's head is at a cathedral. It's just,
where's that? I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I don't know if it's in Siena. I can't remember. You know, I have to check my diary or go online and figure it out. But I saw a lot of cathedrals, and I understand how they kept a hold on people's minds then. It's gotten harder now, though, Riley.
Yeah.
The Catholic Church has taken some hits here, obviously because of sexual scandals, and this was on Pope John Paul II's watch, the moving of priests around to avoid prosecution. I mean, and this was an epidemic scandal in this country, and now they're trying to bounce back. We'll talk a little bit about that when we come back, and we'll listen to some sound from Martin Luther King later in the show.
Yes, we will. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
That's a little electric mud. Muddy Waters, electric. Yeah, it's wild. That's a wild album. 34 past the hour, Mark Maron. It's Morning's Edition with myself and Mark Riley there.
Good morning.
Here on Air America Radio. And now prayer for the new pope. Please, God. I know you're choosing your next pope, and I hope you take these suggestions from a Jewish guy to heart, even though I'm really not involved in the whole thing, you know, popery, I guess, you know, at all, really. But anyways, maybe for your next pope, you could pick a messenger who wasn't so frail this time. It hurt just watching this last guy, at least near the end. He came off like a baby bird dying on the sidewalk. And Lord, maybe he could ease up on the gays and lesbians. I heard angels have both sets of genitals, so that might be a jumping off point if you're looking for a rationale. Maybe he could speak English this time, so when I heard him, it wouldn't be like feel so weird and anachronistic like a Fellini film, you know? But maybe he could also be a little cooler to 13-year-old girls who have their whole lives ahead of them, but they get knocked up by some neighbor douchebag and really shouldn't be starting families right now, maybe. You know what I'm saying? Maybe you could also take a look at the basement, you know, the basement in the Vatican and say, hey, you know, we sure have a lot of frickin' treasure down here. Do we need all this? Why don't we have a yard sale and feed the poor with the proceeds? And maybe, like, if a guy who works for him gets a little crazy and has, you know, I don't know, like lots of sex with Sunday schoolers, why not keep those guys down in the vaults where they used to store the treasure? What do you think? Anyway, Lord... These are just a few thoughts about what the next pope should be like. And, thy will, though, Lord, thy will. Amen. Now, apparently there's some sort of strange, you know, there's all these sort of strange rituals, obviously, in Catholicism, and I'm no student. You know, I'm no theology major. I'm not a student of the church. A lot of people criticize me. They say, you don't even know what you're talking about. Why don't you read the Bible? Because I don't want to make the time. And the thing is that, you know, we do have a theology major on staff here. Brendan P.W. McDonald was a theology major.
Yes.
Yeah, what happened to you?
Well, yeah. It was a Jesuit education, so that always steers a little bit to the left.
Why did you become a theology student or major?
The philosophy department was full. And, I was raised Catholic, and I guess the simplest way I could say it is I needed a blueprint in order to say why I objected to, you know, my upbringing so much. I needed to be able to say, like, logically, wow, this stuff is all political, basically. Yeah. And when you string it through, you know, it kind of, you know, in a meta sense of all different religions, it you really get to understand the politics of it. It actually helped me in terms of, in like a poli-sci way, too, to be a theology major and learn, you know, politics throughout the ages.
Well, I'm surprised that, you know, the Catholic Church, even here in New York, still has a certain amount of power. You know, I mean, they're able to shut down...
Oh, a tremendous amount of power.
They're able to shut down radio shows at the drop of a hat. You know, when Opie and Anthony did that prank over at St. Patrick's.
Yeah.
But let's talk about what happens now in terms of how do they choose the next pope. And did they... You were telling me on the break that there's something they said they didn't do.
Yeah. Well, usually the ritual is to actually take the corpse... And the members of the Curie, the Italian governing body of the church, will whack him in the head with a silver hammer three times to make sure that there's no life in the corpse.
It has to be the silver hammer. It's probably been the same head-whacking Pope hammer.
That's
for
what the
centuries.
Song is. Bang, bang, bang Maxwell's silver hammer.
That's, down on his head.
That's what it's about.
Wow.
And, yes, and then they shout his name out three times.
See if he's up?
Yeah.
After they've hit him in the hammer.
Yeah, so they actually released a statement saying they were not doing that this time.
Hey, that's a lie. Of course they did it. You know that, you know, and that's like Orthodox Jews saying we're not wearing our yarmulkes today. They're just trying to make themselves look good, like we didn't smack them with the hammer because we're not crazy like that anymore. Of course they did it. Why would they tell people that? Were they going to come out with the hammer and go, "We just did it"? We just hit him in the head three times.
PR move.
Yeah, three times. We said, "John, John, John." Nothing. So he's dead. Okay, and we're still crazy. We'll talk to you later. What, am I wrong?
I wouldn't think that it would wind up being such a great thing to put in the papers the next day.
Well, especially now since they're trying to rebuild their image after, like, what was it, 7 million cases of child abuse, sexual assault, or pedophilia?
Right, and, well, that's what you were saying to me earlier, that it seems like that actually the death of the Pope seems almost like a spurring of a Catholic resurgence.
Yeah, well, the Schiavo thing was the big setup in the sense that it was the first time I'd seen a priest on television, you know, really talking about anything or getting involved, and now that, you know, there is some movement in the church. But also what I didn't know is under this particular pope, you know, you would think because Catholicism in the United States took such a profound hit that it would be taking a hit everywhere, but that's not the case. Under the 26 years that he was in office, I guess, as pope, apparently he took it from like 750 million Catholics to up over a billion.
Well, he's put in a lot of FaceTime.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, you know, that's the probably the number one thing a pope can do for the Catholic Church is be their big ticket item on the road. He is, you know,
he was one of the first guys to do that. He was the first real touchy feely pope.
Right.
Like, you know, he'd go out. He was like the Clinton of popes.
Right. And quite honestly, he did a lot of things that he didn't have to do.
Yeah.
You know, apologizing for the Catholic Church's sins throughout the ages.
That made a lot of people feel better, didn't it?
Well,
we didn't help the Jews out, okay?
It actually, though, it did wind up leaving a mark as, like, maybe there is reform in my for the Catholic Church. But then again, this is a pope who has been staunchly opposed, not just to gays and abortion, which are tropes of the church, but also to any kind of reform in terms of letting women or married clergymen into the ranks.
And he's also very opposed to dying. This pope lasted a very long time.
Yeah.
and insisted on doing it in public, which actually I think was sort of a unique thing, that, you know, his insistence to continue working and being public and speaking when he was, you know, physically compromised by age, I thought was actually a decent message to people who are old.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe, you know, I mean, am I being too giving?
Well, one of the things that, in terms of looking at this papacy, he really, I mean, he could have stepped down.
Yeah.
When the illness got to be very, very rough for him, he could have stepped down. He chose not to do that. And as a result, he served for an entire generation. I mean, Pope Pius XII, who served for a pretty long period of time, didn't quite serve 20 years. Pope Paul VI served about maybe 15 years or so. This was 26 years.
That's right. Profound.
Well, it's my lifetime,
wow.
And I've never seen a pope, you know, make the transition. I've never seen the transitioning process, but I've studied, you know, what goes into choosing an ex-pope, and you're going to see the television media is going to love this because it gets they don't have to do any real kind of homework for the next few months on this stuff. They can just allow it to work like a presidential campaign and let it be a horse race. But just know that the front runners that you're going to be seeing on TV, those probably aren't going to be, any one of them will probably not be the next pope.
They very rarely pick the guy they say is going to be the
a lot runner. There's going to be a lot of Catholicism coming up. We're going to come back and begin our week of What's So Special About America with an interview with Ted Fishman, the author of China Incorporated. After this, it's 42 past the hour.
MorningsEdition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningsEdition.com. Air America Radio.
Forty-six past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Morning Sedition, Air America Radio. There's the fax machine with the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Write these down, folks. Here are your marching orders for today. One, now that the Pope has died, make a list of every outraged accusation, cutting comment, snide remark, and vicious slur you ever said about him, and save that list and mail it to the next Pope. Two, April is National Anxiety Month. Until May 1st, go to your special place. Three, go to NCAA Finals protest Illinois Illini for demeaning Native Americans. Figure out who the hell the North Carolina Tar Heels are demeaning so you can complain about that, too. Four, observe daylight savings time by reminding Republicans to set their clocks ahead to 2005. Five, today's phrase, just drop this in the conversation. I don't know how the College of Cardinals counts the votes for the next pope, but if Diebold is involved, get ready for Pope Cheney the First. Wake up, sheeple, it's Ohio all over again. Right now, we're beginning our week-long theme of What's So Special About America. The first segment that we are going to be exploring that, we're going to be exploring the vast productivity of China and India and how it shakes the foundation of the U.S. economic supremacy. We did an interview the other day with the author of China Incorporated, How the Rise of the Next Superpower Challenges America and the World. Here's our interview with Ted Fishman. Good morning, Ted. Thank you for joining us.
I'm glad to be with you.
Good morning.
So now, Ted, there's a lot of things I don't understand about economics. And, you know, the sort of threat of China, you know, becoming the big economic superpower, as we are that now, has been being talked about, you know, more, like, I hear something about it almost every day. What has to happen for this to take place?
Well, the main thing that has to happen is the Chinese people have to get a little richer than they are right now. The Chinese only need a per capita income, an average income for every Chinese person, one-fifth that of the Americans, in order to have the world's largest economy, because they're five times as big as we are. And if the Chinese have a per capita income equal to the people of Hong Kong or Singapore, they'll have an economy five times as big as ours.
Just because there are so many people there.
Right, because there's so many people, and one thing that makes it look inevitable is that they are on the move. Their incomes have gone up fourfold in the last 20 years. Their economy is growing faster and more robustly than any economy in the history of the world.
Now, Ted, I'm curious about something else here. When we talk about the Chinese being very low paid, certainly under communism, most Chinese people were I guess, exposed to certain benefits, in exchange for not being paid all that well. How has some of their transitioning to capitalism impacted on those benefits, education, health care, that sort of thing?
God, that's such a good question. The transition to a market-based economy really builds on some of these amazing strengths that they got under communism. For all of the backwardness of the way the economy ran, the communist regime did introduce housing, health care, education to its workforce. It also made the mass of the Chinese workforce, the rural workforce, highly mobilizable and, for the first time in Chinese history, really disciplined in a large way in which you can move workers to new tasks in a short period of time, get them to adjust. And when you hear these phenomenal numbers of how many people are going into Chinese cities from the countryside, you know, the number is, you know, over the next 10 years, the total migration will top 300 million. It'll be more than, you know, all of the people in America. You know, will be lifting themselves off of Chinese farms, going into Chinese factories and Chinese cities. They're doing that because of the benefits which the communist regime offered them as workers and as citizens.
Okay, so let me understand something. You've got a tremendous movement of people from the rural areas of China moving into cities, yet in cities some people are being pushed out, and, you know, is there some sort of strange exchange going on? What happens to those people that are pushed out of their housing in the cities?
Well, it's quite interesting. One of the most interesting things I did in researching the book was look at some of the housing projects where people who had been displaced by big development projects in the premier areas of cities, and this was in Shanghai, had been moved to the peripheral of the city into these giant, sprawling, you know, complexes of government housing.
So projects.
Yeah, projects. So China's cities are growing exponentially. You know, China adds the equivalent of a city of a million people every month.
So let me just understand then, that a lot of these people that have been pushed out of the cities, I guess, into these projects, are the people that are working in the factories for nothing and generating, you know, the manufacturing base of China.
Yeah, they're still in the cities. They're just in the crummy parts of the city.
Now, let me just say, in China, apparently things have shifted, that what's going on now, according to your book, is that they're not just, you know, making copies and reproductions or pirated things. What's happening now, and I guess which I'm assuming is one of the problems with America's ability to keep up, is that China is generating new products, new technologies. They're at the cutting edge.
Yeah, Mark, they're doing all that. That's what's so impressive about the Chinese economy is they get us in the low end of the economy where they do copy everything that we make, but they're also moving up the economic feeding chain, making things for the world's best companies, making things for their own companies, which are mimicking many of the world's best companies.
Ted, there was a recent report, and we've seen these over time, that are decrying human rights abuses, alleged and otherwise, in China. What would happen, for the sake of argument, if America began to deal with China's economy based on its human rights record, something that we hear occasionally some politicians talk about doing?
Well, yeah, that is so complicated. It's increasingly complicated over the last couple of years because, you know, what the kind of moral authority that we've lost on human rights issues because of our policies around the world. And the Chinese make a lot of hay of that. You would see, the first thing you would see would be that American business would just scream bloody murder because they are so vested in China right now. And they really see China as indispensable to their global operations. You also might see lots of complaint on the part of consumers, you know, because this low-wage manufacturing Goliath delivers an enormous savings to American consumers that, acting individually, we want to seize those savings. In my book, I have this calculation, which is already about 18 months old, that China saves on average every American $550 at the cash register. And, you know, that's twice the savings of the Bush tax cut.
That's unbelievable. And, you know, let me ask you, Ted, it seems to me, and I've heard a lot about this, and I've heard people sort of pay lip service to the fact that, you know, we are actually, the United States economically is literally, you know, operating at the behest of China in some respects, that they have the power on some level to collapse us from the inside economically. Is that possible?
Well, it is possible. It's very possible. We have the power to collapse each other. We exist together in this really tenuous you know, codependency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one way to think about China, it's 1/10 the size of the United States. Our manufacturing sector is as large as China's whole economy. But the way it's acting, it's acting a little bit like a new super hot, super efficient factory in a company town. You know, it changes the business of the changes the way of business of the established players, and it turns them all on their head. And not only does it do it in fact, but it also convinces us that a much greater threat is coming, and that we have to re-examine every corner of the way we do business in this country.
Isn't it interesting that, you know, because of a history of communism, that there is a type of workforce there that is so ambitious and so ready to work and so skilled that it has created a capitalism that is unbeatable?
Yeah, that is one of the great ironies. You know, and for me, one of the unsettling bits of that irony is how much the rest of the world really loves an authoritarian regime. You know, everybody talks about, you know, bringing markets to countries, and it lets democracy flower, and it lets the rule of law flower, and free trade comes. You know, but, you know, China is still very much an authoritarian place run by a single party system and a group of governors who no one ever elected. And yet it is the favorite place for the rest of the world to do business right now. There is no God-given right for the United States to be the largest, richest economy in the world. We just have to figure out how to play the new landscape really intelligently. Make sure we have really smart people. Make sure we have really innovative people. Most importantly, we have to protect the products that we make that the world pays for. You know, you said China counterfeits a lot of things in their economy. A lot of that stuff is our knowledge products, software, entertainment, all the things you can transfer with the click of a mouse. We don't get paid for that in China.
So we need some sort of regulation or global policing in terms of guaranteeing copyrights.
Absolutely. We have to use our power as China's number one customer right now to enforce the rules that will help us get paid. Right now, those rules don't exist.
Ted Fishman, the book is China, Inc., How the Rise of the Next Superpower Challenges America and the World. It was a pleasure talking to you. Hope to talk to you again.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark. Okay, take care.
Wow. You know, there are some numbers. It's interesting because I know this is a delicate topic with a lot of our listeners and a lot of people in this country in terms of what it does to, you know, the manufacturing base in this country and jobs in this country and, you know, what it means to have all those jobs leave this country and why, you know, how do we compete with the cheap labor that is gotten by American companies abroad. We'll talk a little bit more about it over the top of the hour, Riley.
We are. We're also going to talk to our good friend Sam Rosenfeld about the week ahead in Washington. The Democrats may be on the warpath, Mark Maron. We'll tell you what about when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Six past the hour. It's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
How are you, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, and some of you with a sense of humor came out to see me in San Francisco. I really appreciate you coming out. Mark and I appreciate all the gifts. I brought them back in my bag.
Yeah.
You know, some lesser radio personalities would have thrown them away or said, you know what, they're never going to know. But no, I bring everything back. I gave Marky his present. We got the CDs. We got everything. We're also welcoming a couple new affiliates, Pulse Radio, WANRAM 1570 in Warren and Youngstown, Ohio, where Morning Sedition airs 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time. And welcome to Progressive Talk 1270 in Davenport, Iowa, where we air from 5 to 8 a.m. Central Time. And I want to thank the Quake in San Francisco, KQKE 960, for all they did in promoting my performances, Eric Cobb's Comedy Club. What a great turnout. What a great time we had. Also, Talk City in Sacramento, AM 1240. Thank you guys for coming down and promoting. Some people did make the trip. And I'll tell you, Riley, very appreciative. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. Before we get off topic, though, let's get into we're doing, you know, what's so great about America Week is a sense is that, you know, we were once it. We were once the big ones. We were once the country that had it all. We were top-notch economically and in every other way. And now we're starting to take some hits. And I read this, you know, I know that somebody out there You know, you have a problem with Thomas Friedman. I understand. I have a slight problem with Thomas Friedman. But he wrote a piece in the New York Times Magazine this weekend discussing what he called this flat earth theory, you know, which is that, you know, we are no longer in because of communications, because of the internet, because of technology, and because of the way that, you know, that people can engage in business and creative transactions over the internet in many different countries, people from many different backgrounds. It transcends language. It transcends time almost, that we are now not working in a vertical situation. We are working in a flat situation where networks are created. And that is why so much, you know, that the standard rules of economics and manufacturing, you know, no longer apply. And we're in this, you know, tremendous new phase of the free market development. Now, I'm just addressing this. I'm not, you know, I'm no economics wizard, you know, by far from it. But I am concerned about, you know, people being able to be employed and being able to be part of whatever this next phase of free market creativity is going to be. There doesn't seem to be any way to really dismantle the free market. I think those conversations are a little ridiculous for the most part. But, you know, I do care about, you know, the fact that it apparently, in many of these countries where where people weren't involved in global markets, that there's a hunger there and there is an ambition there, and now because of the availability of resources, a lot of different countries are generating, you know, a lot of brilliant engineers, designers, and this and that, that we're not really part of the global game before. And America as well creates a lot of great engineers, and we have our great minds here. But how are we going to compete if companies in this country keep bringing, you know, allowing the work to be sent elsewhere for cheaper? And, you know, Friedman talks about how, you know, we have to get a new type of competitive spirit, that we as individuals, people who are engineers, who are designers, who are, you know, doing this type of work, need to figure out a way how to break through into these broader global markets on their own, you know, without, you know, the help of necessarily a company or a broader corporation or whatnot. But they've got to figure out how they become a functioning prolific cog in this new global machine.
Well, what's interesting about this new global machine, Mark, is that it doesn't operate in all cases as a level playing field. I read an interesting article. We were talking with Ted Fishman about China.
Yeah.
I read a very interesting article about China not too long ago, where they talked about the fact that Motorola had gone into China and had started, of course, developing cell phones.
Yeah.
Now, China's cell phone use is exploding.
Apparently, there's more cell phones in China than there are people in the United States.
Yeah, at this point. And they're adding people, cell phone users, at some ridiculously high rate every month, right?
Right.
Well, what the Chinese did was initially welcome Motorola into the country. And they started, you know, doing the handsets and that sort of thing. But all the while, the Chinese are checking out the technology, and eventually, and Motorola knew this, eventually Motorola was, more or less, asked to leave. Because it was time for the Chinese to start manufacturing their own stuff based on the technology that Motorola had brought there. What that means is that, yes, American business can make some short-term gains in some of these countries. But as they begin to develop their own technological templates, they're not going to be as receptive to American-manufactured goods as we are to their manufactured.
Well, that's going to be a problem economically, and there's a problem that apparently, you know, most of our debt is to China, and there's the issue that, like, just on a personal level, you know, I obviously, when I say cog in the machine, you know, that doesn't have good connotations, but, you know, creativity along with ingenuity and education are very important things, in this country, and I don't think that we are lazy in any way, but I think we have a little more comfort than they do in other countries. But the thing that I realized when I read this article by Friedman in terms of the global landscape and how everybody has access to everything, you can see how that's changing even in the music world, in the art world, in different infusions of other types of creativity from other countries. And I feel a little out of touch. You know, I'm just a guy who stands on a stage and talks about my stupid little problems and my stupid little world, whereas we have this incredibly multi-ethnic, multinational world that is right on our doorstep all the time, that there is a sort of I don't want to use synergy. I don't know what the word I'm trying to look like, but it really is becoming a completely diverse
landscape for everybody.
It is a diverse landscape, and what you're starting to see happen now, Mark, is the people are beginning to question whether corporate America is up to the task of competing in this new global economy. We've been so busy giving our CEOs, you know, seven-figure bonuses every year. People are starting to say, you know, is this corporate structure that we've developed here, where corporations in many instances, certainly if you look at some of the legislation guys like Tom DeLay passed, you'd think that they, you know, ruled the country. Well, is that corporate rule going to be strong enough to make the inroads around the world that we think they should be? You know, if you're paying somebody a seven-figure bonus, if you're a stockholder, you pretty much figure, well, okay, yeah, I guess you're going to be able to compete in the global marketplace. These corporations are going to be tested, very, very sorely tested, and we may have to come up with a different model
right.
in America.
But a lot of them will be fine because they can, you know, they can draw on all this cheap labor that isn't in America. And then also, I think the real challenge is to individuals, too, who have the education, who have the creativity and the how to figure out a way to break through, you know, on their own with a couple other guys. Those are always the dramatic stories, the entrepreneurial stories of you know, people who are in the graphic design field or in the engineering field who can somehow find their place in this global economy. I mean, Robert Reich talks about that in his book Reason. When it comes right down to it, a lot of these guys don't feel like these manufacturing jobs are going to come back to the States anytime soon, and they feel that, you know, that the real places for progress are in creative fields and in healthcare fields and in private health care, which is weird. I'd like to talk to Robert Reich and Thomas Friedman about what the hell they're thinking and how this is going to appeal to or really help the American workforce. You know, because we also have a contingent in this country, these treasonous anti-American religious fanatics who want nothing more than to retard our young people with an education that does not, you know, provide them with what they need to be part of this new global economy, to be part of the progressive world, to be rational thinkers, to be given a fact-based education. You have Tom DeLay and his group of anti-American treasonous people that want to overrun the American government and reframe the judicial branch into some sort of, you know, Judeo-Christian moralizing front. I mean, these people should really be seen as they are, is that they are doing, for political reasons, they are trying to retard the populace. We'll talk a little bit about that when we come back, about DeLay, about Congress. We're going to talk to Sam Rosenfeld. Is that next? That's coming back in a little while.
Yeah.
But in the next segment, maybe we will stay on this a little bit and lead into Sam Rosenfeld in a little bit of a discussion about DeLay and about what's up in Congress coming up in a little bit more about you, our listeners. Read a couple emails. It's 15 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Twenty past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. My therapist asked me to keep track of all my dreams, so this is my dream diary from last night. I'm walking down the long, dark corridor. It's lit by candles. Somewhere soft organ music is playing. A voice echoes down the corridor. Mr. Maron. Mr. Maron. Mr. Maron. Up ahead, I see the outline of a man in a black suit. I walk up to him. I say, yes. And it's me, as a mortician. He's got hollowed-out eyes, and his fingernails are 6 inches long and painted blood red. A raven is perched on his shoulder. Mortician Mark says, sit down, please. Now, Mr. Maron, what sort of death were you looking for? I sit and I say, I don't know. What are my choices? He says, we could have you die after 15 years in a coma, triggering a craven attempt by the religious right to impose their hypocritical values on the rest of the nation. I say, it sounds complicated. What else have you got? We could have you die after a long public illness, triggering an extravagant show of grief from millions of your religious followers, even though you outlived your usefulness 5 years before. I say, I'm not big on the Jesus angle. Next, he taps on his long red nail on his temple and says, we could have you get blown up in a car bomb in Iraq. You'd be a hero. I shake my head and I say, I don't know. I don't want anything quite that messy. How about if I die quietly in a bed at age 90 or so after a long, fulfilling life? Mortician Mark stands up and points at me. Where's the publicity in that? Where's the drama? Don't you want to go out with a splash? I said, no, not really. I'll just go out with the getting old and dying in bed plan. Very well, Mr. Maron. Sign this. While I'm signing the contract, I say, so how's business? Mortician Mark sighs and says, good.
very good. And the raven says, cash or charge? I woke up and my bed was filled with embalming fluid.
Ooh.
Yeah, whatever.
Cash or charge? Cash or charge?
Here we go. Moving into this. Riley, what are we going to do? We got the, let me just read this email first. Here we go. Thank you for being there. I wanted to say that first. I disagree with the critic who thought Mark was a prima donna in the earliest days of the network and the show. This is in reference, I think, to the HBO special. He was on edge, like everyone else in the documentary seemed on edge. If Clutch Larson hadn't taken him aside and told him he shouldn't keep his opinions to himself to vent after leaving the microphone, he would never have known how truly informed and literate he really is. Aww. Sometimes he, and many of his peers on the network, seem more like political science mavens than comedians. Yes, that's a compliment. I really like the Thursday radio serial spoof, Shadow Government, and I don't mind hearing the names of all the people who work behind the scenes to drive the show. But I wonder, how did Kent Jones get the nickname The Colonel? Again, many thanks. Well, the etymology of the colonel in this particular usage is has to do directly with Kent's love of Elvis.
Ah.
Yes, I believe that is exactly where the colonel came from. It's a reference to Colonel
Tom Parker, yeah.
Yeah, who took everything Elvis had.
Ah.
And he likes, and Kent likes the fact that Parker just called himself that.
Yeah.
He gave the nickname to himself. No one gave it to him. So in honor of Elvis and Colonel Tom Parker, Kent gave himself the name
The Colonel.
Now, also, again, welcome to our new affiliates, Pulse Radio, WANR AM 1570 in Warren and Youngstown, Ohio. We're on 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and welcome to Progressive Talk 1270 Davenport, Iowa, where we will air from 5 to 8 a.m. Central Time. Now, let's get into what the Congress has reconvened today. Is that right, Riley?
Yeah, they're back in session.
There's a lot of things on the plate. You know, they are going to, I guess we can talk to Sam Rosenfeld about the confirmation of Mr. Bolton, if that's going to happen. Do you think that's going to happen?
You know, the Democrats seem to be showing a little spine when it comes to Bolton.
Well, the guy's horrendous.
Yeah, he is. He's a nightmare. And the UN is the last place you want an American nightmare. But, you know, the Bush administration plans to try and push this through. They've got the numbers as far as the Senate's concerned. But there seems to be some questions, and by the way, these are not new questions and accusations. Accusations, in fact, that John Bolton walked around like a bully when it came to intelligence. Now, where have we heard that before?
Yeah, well, that's the party line with this administration.
Yeah, well, apparently he tried to either intimidate or victimize two career intelligence officials for what he viewed, and this is according to an article in Newsweek, what he viewed as their insufficiently alarmist analyses of intel on purported Cuban biological weapons.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, get on the program. This is the same kind of thing that we saw in terms of speculation about Vice President Dick Cheney when he made those trips out to CIA headquarters back not too long ago in the run-up to the war in Iraq, where the intelligence has to fit the administration construct. And it looks like Bolton was also one of those point men.
Okay. So he's got a long history with the Republican Party of being kind of thuggy.
Yeah, kind of thuggy.
He was involved with the Iran-Contra. He was a guy that was, you know, was one of the great deniers of the drug runner money, which turned out to be true thanks to John Kerry's investigation of that and John Kerry and many others within the Senate. But this guy was up to his neck with that stuff as well.
Well, yeah, and he was, you know, he's one of his running partners is Otto Reich, who was one of the top policymakers on Latin America. And, you know, they first tried to get rid of one analyst because they thought he was too soft on Cuba, and he was once assigned to Bill Clinton's National Security Council. And he thought, according to Reich, that the work was unreliable. But apparently George Tenet, and this must be the only time this happened when he was CIA director, resisted pressure from Bolton and Reich, and the analyst was ultimately promoted on Tenet's watch. Now, these little colonels, not to use a play on words here, but these little colonels are not necessarily going to be what the Democrats can hang their hat on. But the idea of a guy who has essentially poo-pooed the very idea of the United Nations and America's role in it, for him to be moved to become the United States ambassador. We cannot afford, I don't think, Mark, another Gene Kirkpatrick in that kind of gig.
And also, 59 former U.S. ambassadors signed a letter opposing Bolton's nomination as ambassador to the U.N. 46 of these ambassadors served in Republican administrations. So this guy's got to be bad news.
He is bad news. I don't know whether he will, in fact, be.
Nobody likes him.
Nobody likes him, but see, Bush likes him, and Bush likes that kind of tough, tough exterior that a Bolton would bring to the UN and bring to, you know, Bolton could always threaten to, you know, well, we'll just, you know, we'll stop our funding. The whole Jesse Helms obstructionist point of view when it comes to dealing with the UN.
But also, it seems like, you know, Bush, this administration rewards people that's carried water for them in the past if it's dirty water.
No matter what their competence.
Right. Negroponte, it doesn't make a difference. If they've done some dirty deeds, that they will be rewarded.
Yes, loyalty in this administration is currency.
Yeah.
We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk to Sam Rosenfeld. We got a lot more for you, so stay with us. The Morning Remembrance is up soon on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Unfortunately, folks, it is that time of week again when we here at Morning Sedition take a moment at this time of sorrow to reflect in our morning remembrance.
As the people of the grieving nation come together to mourn, to remember, and finally to find hope, Morning Sedition joins with them to mourn, remember, and find hope as well. And so we bring you the stories of those who have lost their lives, those who inspire us to carry on. Here now is Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
David Bushnell, founder of Bushnell Binoculars. David Bushnell, founder of Bushnell Binoculars, died last week after a long period of slipping in and out of focus. Bushnell started his business back in 1948, when he imported the first two crates of binoculars to the States and helped introduce millions of middle-class Americans to the bathroom windows of millions of other middle-class Americans.
You all right?
Yeah, it's just getting hard to see in here, too. Allergies are going to clear up my eyes. Ironically, the company is now based in Kansas, a place where there's absolutely nothing to look at. A lot of wheat and alfalfa there.
Got allergies to that stuff?
Yeah. Bushnell requested his body be polished, kept out of the sun, and put back in its case. Damn it. Or there'll be hell to pay this time. You damn kids have no respect for my possessions. This time it's coming out of your allowance. Do you want the belt?
Wow. You want a Kleenex or something?
Yeah, I don't know what happened there. Sorry, these antihistamines kind of make me a little emotional. Thank you. Our next one.
Okay.
Frank Perdue, chicken magnate. Frank Perdue, founder of Perdue Chicken, has finally bought the farm. Police say there's no truth to the rumor his body was found totally battered. Battered. Sixty years ago, Perdue took a small backyard egg business and built it into the world's largest source of torture and abuse since the heyday of the Catholic Church. Speaking of hay, I'm allergic to hay.
Are you?
I'm
getting a little watery, too, here.
Yeah, there must be cushions in here made of with stuff with hay or something. Because I got some, my eyes are teared up.
Oh, man.
Perdue sold billions of chickens using the folksy slogan, "It takes a tough man to make a tender chicken." which coincidentally was also his favorite pickup line. Tender chickens. Tender chickens.
Okay.
Yeah. Associates remember his favorite riddle was, why did the chicken producer cross the road? Of course, the answer was always the familiar, to hire the New York Mafia to keep his employees from unionizing.
You need a Kleenex here?
Yeah,
Kleenex.
Yeah, I think you got some down down cushions in here. Are you wearing a down jacket?
You're looking right at me. Am I wearing a down jacket?
Oh. I think...
Blow your nose.
Take it. Oh, man.
Okay. Try and get through this thing.
Thank you. Purdue is survived by four children, all of whom were raised in a single shed at a density of only 1 square foot of space per child, and bred to grow so fast that they are now on the verge of structural collapse. The deceased requested his body be hung by the feet from a conveyor belt, dropped into a vat of scalding water, while factory employees gleefully tossed pieces of his nose and fingers at each other. Ah, you saw that video, right?
Yeah, I did, man.
Oh, man.
That's heartbreaking stuff.
I wish I could get rid of this nose.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm not crying. I'm not crying. It's just allergies.
Yeah, I'm sure it is allergies. So, did you overlook the Pope somehow?
The Pope's a great man. He did a lot of good. I think it's an incredible thing to just absolve Galileo after 300 years. Took a lot of courage to do that, admit that the sun actually is the universe. What a man.
You all right, man? You got more?
I'm just going to sign off.
Okay. Well, it's nice seeing you, man. Did you have a good weekend?
Yeah, I had a great weekend. A lot of good deaths over the weekend.
Now, do you have these allergies at home as well? Or?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I got a lot of animals. I got ferrets and cats. Yeah, I got a buddy.
Yeah, okay.
Buddy.
Okay, buddy. Well, why don't you go ahead and sign off.
This has been this week's Morning Remembrance. Till next time, this is Morton Mortensen saying, who's jumping in?
All right, Mort. Thanks.
Thank you, Mort.
Thank you.
All right, right now, to talk to us, we have our regular congressional guy. Is he officially our congressional guy?
There you go.
He's a web writer for the American Prospect. He covers Congress. Sam Rosenfeld, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Hey,
well,
Sam.
We're okay, man. You know, you guys are starting up again today down there?
Yeah, sure.
So now what is going to happen with John Bolton? Is the Democrats, are they going to be able to get enough Republicans to stop this thing from happening?
Probably not.
Come on.
Well, it's baby steps. There's going to be unanimous Democratic opposition. That's the most we can do.
But I heard a lot of Republicans think this guy's dirty, Sam.
Sure.
He's a bad man from all accounts, and I thought that some Republicans were starting to turn on each other with this thing.
Well, I mean, it's not entirely hopeless. I mean, it's going to – if he makes it to the floor, he'll eventually get he'll get confirmed. But in the Foreign Relations Committee, there are three moderate Republicans that people have been mobilizing against Bolton are targeting, and that's Richard Lugar is the head of the committee and on foreign policy, is very moderate and doesn't like Bolton. Chuck Hagel and then Lincoln Chafee, the most moderate of all Republicans.
So if they don't confirm him, that doesn't do anything?
Well, there's a 10-8 split between Republicans and Democrats on that committee, and all eight Democrats are very likely going to vote against him, and if they can get one of these guys, it still goes to the floor, but it goes without a recommendation from the Foreign Relations Committee, and that might give cover to enough moderate Republicans to just derail the entire nomination. So it really will come down to the hearings, which start on Thursday. It might go on because it's going to be very contentious and covering a lot of dirty dealings in this guy's past.
Now, Sam, it's interesting you didn't mention George Voinovich. Is he solidly in Bolton's corner?
I'm not sure. Has he said something about it? No one's paid attention to Voinovich. as far as I can tell, these three are the ones that everyone's been focusing on.
Yeah, I'm figuring he might be a moderate. He might be moderate enough to maybe cross party lines here.
Yeah, I mean, what matters right now is who's on the Foreign Relations Committee. Outside of the committee, another guy who's pretty outspoken in his disapproval of Bolton is Pete Domenici, who has criticized him.
From my home state.
Yeah.
Yeah, who's criticized him for, you know, he's been Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and criticized him for just leaving all these loose nuclear materials out in the former Soviet Union.
So, Sam, how long is it going to take Congress to pick a new pope? I'm sorry, I'm looking at the wrong thing here. Why didn't somebody help me with this? Hey, listen.
Got to go to conference committee first.
Yeah, right.
Stay on the phone, man. We're going to talk to you about the filibuster rule, because I want you to educate me with that stuff. So we'll be back with Sam Rosenfeld after this. It's 43 past the hour.
Morning's Edition, on the air and online. Morning'sEdition.com, Air America Radio.
Yeah, it's 47 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. We're on the phone with the web writer for the American Prospect, Sam Rosenfeld. He's our guy on the congressional beat. Sam, explain to me a couple of things about this this desire on behalf of the Republicans to change the filibuster rule. How can they? Why is it that this is even a conversation? How can they just change the rules of Congress that were laid out, as the way it's supposed to be in Congress to tilt it their favor? I don't understand that.
Well, what the justification is basically the Senate makes its own rules, and yes, it's been governed by these rules for the past two centuries or so, but you know they can change them when they want, and there is a procedural way that they can do it, getting the Senate parliamentarian, who is Dick Cheney, to make a kind of unilateral rule change to eliminate filibuster for judicial nominees. The reason this is happening now, this is something that the hard right conservative senators have wanted for a while, since they've been in the majority in the Senate, but it's gotten steadily, you know, as the atmosphere has gotten steadily more partisan, more polarized, and with the election in November electing a few more conservatives to Senate, they think they have enough votes to do it. I don't think they have enough votes to do it, but it'll be close.
Why? Because there are some people that still, you know, respect the way that the government is supposed to work?
Exactly. There are still enough, even there's the moderates who are on record being, you know, Lincoln, Chafee, Snow, McCain, who are on record opposing it or being very hesitant about it. But there are enough conservatives who are guys who have been around in the Senate for a while, are kind of institutionalists, respect the fact that there are rules and you know, adhere to some sort of ethic of compromise and working within the institution with their Senate colleagues. I'm thinking of people like John Warner.
These are guys that realize that they have anti-American treason people in their midst who want to religify the judiciary branch, don't you think?
Sure. I mean, you're going to see a lot as they start pushing for this. You're going to see a lot of references to Terry Schiavo, using Terry Schiavo as a new kind of talking point in rallying the conservative base to the idea that we need to, you know, get some conservatives in the judiciary. So that's going to be their next line of attack.
Now, Sam, can they do this without, I mean, is this filibuster rule change only about judicial nominees? I mean, most people, certainly from my generation, remember filibusters being used in a different way, being used to try and stymie civil rights legislation. Would that affect this?
No, well, they're not going to try and outlaw all filibusters, but here's what's going to happen. If they institute the nuclear option to ban filibusters on judicial nominees, the Democrats will retaliate by putting up all sorts of these complicated procedural gimmicks to just basically gum up the regular business of the Senate and essentially shut the Senate down. And that will either force the Republicans to back down or force them to end up lifting the filibuster on everything, and, you know, really putting their money where their mouth is. Do they have enough? Do they have 50 Republicans who would support escalating this, you know, if they want to get anything done in the Senate, to actually get rid of the filibuster altogether? I really don't think that's the case. So they're saying this is just limited to judicial nominees. Democrats are going to try and force their hand and see if that's what they mean. I think what will come out of it, if they, I don't think they have enough votes anyway, but if they do, they'll end up backing down because it's, the Senate's just going to be shut down. It's going to be complete chaos.
Who in the Senate do you see on the Republican side as siding with the Democrats on this?
Well, it's the four moderates who are always kind of forming this block, Chafee, Olympia Snowe, Susan Collins, and John McCain. And then I think there's any number of guys, some of the older senators. I think most clearly John Warner, who's a senator from Virginia, has made reference to being very ambivalent about this, you know, opposes the filibusters the Democrats have been doing, but I don't think he's going to end up signing off on it. And then, you know, Pete Domenici, Voinovich, there's a block of kind of reasonably sober-minded, if actually, you know, if ideologically conservative senators out there who I think are going to be thinking twice about this. Dick Lugar, too.
When is the House going to chew up delay and spit him out? When does that happen? Is that
That ain't going to happen.
Oh, come on.
I think Democrats should be careful about it. I've been impressed by the amount of activism and really getting DeLay's name out there and hammering home and stuff, but Democrats should not want Republicans to get rid of DeLay. He's going to be the gift that keeps on giving for, you know, the next year. If Republicans were smart and not so sort of militant in their unity and embattlement, they would get rid of him right now.
Are they scared of him?
Well, sure. I mean, a lot of them are scared of him, but and they have reason to be. But, you know, I think it's sufficiently clear now that he's just not going to be doing them any good for the next year or so. Democrats and, you know, liberal activist groups are organized now and mobilized to just hammer him home. And the more he fights back, and he's, you know, he's enlisting all these right-wing groups to fight back, the more he becomes a household name. Nobody in America had heard of Tom DeLay, but they're going to start hearing about him.
So you think that, you know, we as being a part of the other side can utilize his presence to continually, you know, chip away at you know, what these sort of anti-constitutional religious fanatics and who he represents do to this country?
Oh, sure. And if you want, you know, the Democrats want to make kind of emulate in some ways the Republicans when they took over in 94 by running in 2006 on this broader reformist critique of corruption in Congress and, you know, throw the bums out, clean up Congress. And Tom DeLay is the emblem of that, and you do not want to just succeed. It'll be a catastrophic success for Democrats to have pressured Republicans so much so soon that that DeLay is out of the picture. You want him around there as the, you know, horrible face of modern Republican governance.
Well, it's interesting because he's horrible on two fronts. That, you know, he is this you know corrupt politician, and he's also this guy that everything that he does to sort of put up a smokescreen in front of his own corruption is pandering to an extreme religious ideology.
Oh, exactly. I mean, that's he's the very epitome of modern Republicanism because it's total corporate cronyism and corruption melded to both pandering, but also, I think, sincerely felt religious extremism and a kind of just hard right conservative.
Yeah, the evangelists, some evangelicals claim that they actually own about 44% of the Republicans in Congress.
Right, right.
Mm. Do you think his problems at home, he's got some recent poll numbers that say support in his district is slipping. Will that impact inside the Beltway at all, sir?
Well, I think it's just more fuel to the fire, gets Democrats even more excited. I mean, you know, there was a smaller wave of this before the election when the Ethics Committee handed down the admonishments and all his cronies in Texas started getting indicted. And no one in the right mind thought he wouldn't get reelected, but his numbers were actually pretty low in Texas. And I would imagine the DCCC is going to be thinking about whether or not to – the guy who's been running against DeLay is his name's Richard Morrison, whether or not they'll start really funding Richard Morrison or decide to get another more formidable candidate and really give DeLay a strong challenge in 2006.
Sounds exciting. Sam Rosenfeld, thank you so much for joining us. Always good talking to you.
Thank you.
Thanks,
take
Sam.
Care. I just want to remind people from this thing I've been citing over the last couple of months, the 14 precepts, I guess, of fascism by Lawrence W. Britt. You know, number, it doesn't matter what number it is, but number 8, religion and ruling elites tied together. These are characteristics of fascist and proto-fascist governments that were basically based on the German model and the Italian model. But unlike communist regimes, the fascist and proto-fascist regimes were never proclaimed as godless by their opponents. In fact, most of the regimes attached themselves to the predominant religion of the country and chose to portray themselves as militant defenders of that religion. The fact that the ruling elite's behavior was incompatible with the precepts of the religion was generally swept under the rug. Propaganda kept up the illusion that the ruling elites were defenders of the faith and opponents of the godless. A perception was manufactured that opposing the power elite was tantamount to an attack on religion. And this is something that characterizes fascist states. So don't condescend to me when I say fascist. Don't look at me and go, really? Fascism? Don't do that.
Does somebody do that? Okay, we
sure
won't worry
do.
About it. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the judiciary and about a conference that's coming up this week in D.C. that features a little man we like to call Tom DeLay. When we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. All you people in San Francisco who came out to see the show over the weekend, thank you. Thank you, all you people at the Quake, KQKE 960, for promoting that show and helping us out at Cobb's. We had a great time. A lot of fans, Riley. A lot of fans. I've been
all
telling
right.
you all morning.
All right.
People coming up, and they're just they're very grateful. They're thankful. They're happy that we're on the air there. And you know, brought some gifts.
I want to thank the people who gave me the. And forgive me, I did open the card, but I don't have it here with me. But the cable car, the music box cable car,
a little musical cable car I got for Riley from one of our fans, and we got Vincent gave us Dick Gregory at Kent State and some other stuff. Gave my wife a T-shirt. Had a good time, and thanks for coming down. Also, thank you Talk City in Sacramento, AM 1240. Thank you guys for coming down. And also, I want to welcome a couple of new affiliates. We're getting up there. Where are we at, Larson? Clutch Larson. We're about 40 at that Morning Sedition is on. We want to welcome Pulse Radio, WANR-AM 1570 in Warren in Youngstown, Ohio, where Morning Sedition airs 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time. And also we want to welcome Progressive Talk 1270, Davenport, Iowa, where we air 5 to 8 a.m. Central Time. I have never been to Iowa. You know
neither
what?
Have I.
I have.
You
I have
been to Iowa.
Dude, I've been to Iowa.
Des Moines?
No, I've been. I think it was called Maryville, Iowa, if I'm not mistaken. This is a very interesting. That was a bad night, dude.
Uh-oh.
Oh man, I get this call from a booker. I just starting to, you know, I was doing comedy not too long, and I get a call from a booker. Said, can you go to Maryville, Iowa? It's a college gig. You rent a car. You drive up. I guess I flew into. I don't even know where the airport is. Like it's so many years ago. I flew in, I rented a car, I drove for many hours through nothing but corn, right? And I'm not judging corn or the state's crop or anything like that, but, you know, when you're driving through hours of corn, you start getting the feeling that, like, this might not be a great gig, you know? So I get to this school, and they were kids, they were fine, you know, but I hadn't gone to the gig yet. And I go to the school, and the guy who's booking the gig comes up to me and says, you know, we just had Anthony Clark last night. We sold out we just had a comedy night the night before last at the pub, and it sold out, you know, and everyone thought you were going to be somebody else, but he canceled. So I don't know how this is going to go, but we got you booked in the theater, you know.
I'd turn right back around, drive that rental car back to the airport, and be smoking back to L.A.
Well, I think I was living here at the time, and we go to this theater. And it must seat like 1,500 people, man.
Uh-oh.
You know, and it's just me and this huge organ on stage, you know. And like, you know, it's 5 to 8. The show's going to start, Riley. Mm-hmm. There's like maybe
15, 16 people spread out in the theater that seats about 800. And I'm like, oh, man, this is going to be the worst. You know, so then, like, I actually say to a kid, I'm like, dude, can I just borrow your watch so I can keep touch, you know, keep track of it? So I get up there, and it's just me, and I just tank, man. I eat it for, like, 44 minutes. I'm in the middle of a joke, Riley. I see my watch hit 45. I'm like, thank you. Good night. You know, and, like, I'm running. I'm running out of the place.
Oh,
I'm running to the parking lot, and I hear some voice go, Mark! And I'm like, hey, somebody might have liked me. And I turn around, and the guy goes, my watch. You still got my watch. So I give him the watch. I'm like, all right, thanks, I guess. And I drove back 3 hours. But, you know, that's no bearing on where I am now. Everything's different. But I do welcome our new Iowa affiliate at Talk 1270 in Davenport, Iowa. If anyone saw that show or was going to that school or knows anything about Maryville or if I'm even talking out my arse here, because I'm pretty sure it was in Iowa, you know, let me know. You know, pitch in, pipe in.
I was at that gig. Watch, somebody's going to call in. I was at that gig.
Call
I was
me right now. Call me right now, 866-303-2270. 70, if you're one of the 16 people at that school that I think was in Maryville, Iowa.
Wow.
Like, those phones are going to light up now. Anyway, so I'm like, now I'm like, is there someone? No, that can't be. They're not going to call. People don't even know we're on the air there yet. So, look, Riley, let's talk about some serious stuff. It is the anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King today.
Yes, this happened April 4th, 1968, and Mark, it began what I believe ended up being an extremely painful period in American history.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking now about the assassination of Martin King in April, the assassination of Robert Kennedy in June, and the Democratic National Convention, which came up late July, early August. So during that period, from April through September, America went through some extraordinary convulsions because, of course, after Dr. King died, there were riots on the streets of numerous American cities. And you know, you had a situation where Dr. King, who staunchly advocated nonviolence throughout his life, his assassination produced some of the most violent convulsions American cities have ever seen. And, you know, it was a very, very sad time. It was a time, I think, that a lot of people who came up during the 60s kind of sort of lost their innocence, kind of sort of realized, like, this is not just, you know, the world is not going to be remade just because we know we're right, kind of thing. When King was killed, people, I think, and I was in military school at the time. I was like a junior in high school. And I remember going, I was walking back from a class or something. And somebody walked through and said, did you hear? And I said, no. What do you mean? He said, Martin Luther King's been shot. At that time, there was a little lag between someone being shot and then them being confirmed killed, even if it happened right, you know, even if they were dead on the scene. There was always a bit of a lag time. It happened during the Kennedy assassination as well. And I remember a group of people gathered in a room to watch the televised coverage of this. Ugh. And everybody knew. 5 minutes in, that this was going to create problems on the streets of cities across America.
Oh, I can't. It's so. I can't imagine what it must have been like to be, you know, alive at that time. Because I know, you know, when I talked to my mother about all the assassinations that went on, that can you just imagine? There was only three sort of television outlets. You know, the world of information was much more intimate, much more selective. So everybody reacted to the same things at the same time, the same tragedies. You know, and when Martin Luther King was killed, when Robert Kennedy was killed, when John F. Kennedy was killed. I mean, I can't even imagine, you know, what that must have been like for the entire culture to have these horrendous things happen like that, and to not, you know, from your own country, from within this country, there was that type of action being taken against people.
The country literally stopped. When King was killed, when Robert Kennedy was killed a couple of months later, the nation stopped because it was like, how could you do this? How could this happen? How could this kind of violence take place? Now, mind you, this kind of violence had been taking place for a number of years. Certainly, Robert Kennedy was assassinated 6 years earlier. His brother was assassinated 5 years earlier. His brother was assassinated.
I can't even imagine what it must have been like to have been alive then.
It was a very, very scary time in a lot of ways, and not just because of the violence that was taking place on the streets. It was the fear that all of the work that so many people had done to try and make America a better place, certainly in the area of civil rights, was going to come to a screeching halt as a result of these assassinations. A lot of people thought, for example, that Robert Kennedy would end up being the president of the United States, that he would win the Democratic nomination and move forward and end up winning the presidency in 1968 against, as it turned out, Richard Nixon. It was kind of the end of an age of innocence in this country. And certainly for Black America, the assassination of Martin King said to a lot of people that might not have believed it beforehand, that civil rights were going to come at a tremendous, tremendous cost.
Wow.
Yeah.
We have a piece of sound about that Martin Luther King addressing dissent.
This was in Atlanta the year before he died.
Can we hear that, Chris?
One of the difficulties in speaking out today grows out of the fact there are those who are seeking to equate dissent with disloyalty. It's a dark day in our nation when high-level authorities will seek to use every method to silence dissent. Something is happening and people are not going to be silent.
Yeah, well, that's certainly happening now.
Prophetic words 38 years ago.
Absolutely. I guess, like, some things, are fairly, consistent in terms of people who are against freedom, against America, against democracy. Unfortunately, these people aren't the dissenters at this point. They are the people that are headed off by Tom DeLay, who are going to be joining each other in some sort of conference. When's that coming up? Later this week, I believe.
The 7th and 8th. The end of the week, Thursday, Friday.
This is the Confronting the Judicial War on Faith. This is a group of traitors that, because of what they believe the judiciary should be, which is Christian, that they are really, want to subvert the judiciary branch of the government, because that's the one that they can't and they don't have hold of right now. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. It's 16 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
Yes, 21 past the hour, Air America Radio. It's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yep.
Once again, I get a little flack for being a little too hard on certain religions. But, when I talk about these Christian right, the fanatics that are infiltrating our government, it's an earnest fear I have, because I respect the separation between church and state. And I see that there is a proto-fascist wave within our government who are really anti-constitutional, anti-American, anti-democratic conservatives that want to align a specific religion with the judicial branch of our government, and that makes me upset, and that makes me extreme in my views. I mean, whether or not I believe in God is not necessarily important, but there's no reason not to be critical of everyone else who does. What? Hey, come on. Yeah, here we go. Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So I just bought a brand new... I didn't buy it. Riley, it's been sitting here in the office
sitting
for
weeks. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Isn't it funny how we commit to this conceit? My iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headliner translator is right here. My headline translator. So let's crank it up and feed it some headlines. Some people were listening Friday. Heard Brendan actually do that live. From Fox News, from Fox News, Pope mourned worldwide. Pope mourned worldwide. Feed that in there. Translation. Pontiff's opposition to birth control breeds millions of grieving supporters. From the New York Times, baseball has first violator of steroid agreement. Let's feed that in. Baseball has first violator of steroid agreement. Translation, demand for clean urine outstrips supply. From Reuters, oral sex safe and not really sex, say U.S. teens. Let's feed that in there. orally. Yes, translation. Pontiff's opposition to birth control resonates with the young. Okay, that's how that goes.
Wait a minute.
What?
You're not finished.
Oh, that's right.
Thank you.
Riley loves that.
Now
I just want to read something that was, this was released after the, you know, the last appeal to a federal court. You know, after the administration, the Bush administration, sought to, you know, overreach, sought to sort of override states' rights and force this thing, the Shiloh case, into the federal courts again after it was reasonably and judicially weighed and heard six times over the last, you know, 15 years. Again, a statement was made by Judge Stanley Birch. Okay, and I want to read this statement because it's important. It's important to realize that not only is Tom DeLay trying to cover his own butt in aligning himself, so as he always has, with religious fanatics, but, you know, he's also trying to, you know, there is a faction within this government that they're traitors. They're anti-American, they're anti-Constitution, they're anti-democracy. And they are trying to usurp the judicial branch of our government and, you know, infiltrate it with their own type of judicial activism. They are trying to get rid of judges that are sitting for their, you know, for their tenure or whatever you call it, their post, you know, that, which is non-political in a sense, that they don't have to be elected. They sit on their benches for as long as they're, you know, they are supposed to sit, which is however long that takes, right? I'm not clear on that, but they are not supposed to answer to these people that want to push them off their seat, you know, to
replace
them.
They want to impeach them.
Yeah, replace them with people that are more aligned with their dogmatic and unconstitutional religious beliefs. Quote, this is from Judge Stanley Birch. A popular epithet directed by some members of society, including some members of Congress, towards the judiciary involves a denunciation of activist judges. Birch wrote, quote, generally the definition of an activist judge is one who decides the outcome of a controversy before him according to personal conviction, even one sincerely held, as opposed to the dictates of the law as constrained by legal precedent and ultimately our Constitution. In resolving the Shiloh controversy, it is my judgment that, despite sincere and altruistic motivation, the legislative and executive branches of our government have acted in a manner demonstrably at odds with our founding fathers' blueprint for the governance of a free people, our Constitution. End quote. Anti-Constitution, anti-American. They are traitors. And this guy is not you know, some liberal. He was appointed to the bench by George H.W. Bush. And he, you know, is not a party line. He's not a, you know, he's.
Oh, there's no way. I mean, this is a guy who ruled that gays in Florida should not be allowed to adopt. So he's certainly no radical. He's certainly not even close to being a liberal. But, Mark, you know, we talked earlier about this conference that's coming up this week in Washington. It's at the Washington Marriott. It's on the 7th and 8th, the end of this week.
Uh-huh.
And they've got virtually a who's who of right-wing ideologues.
Christo-fascist zombie brigade people.
Yeah, and people who really want to create a state religion. That's what these guys are really all about. And maybe when we get back, you can talk about those points about fascism, because that's what these guys are really looking to do. Guys like Tom DeLay, guys like David Gibbs, who was the attorney for the Schindlers, Chief Justice Roy Moore, the guy from Alabama that didn't want to remove the Ten Commandment monument.
Let's read the rest of that list, and, you know, when we come back, we'll take some calls. 866-303-2270. Are these people traitors? Is this anti-American? Isn't it wrong? Where do you stand on what's being, you know, should they pull the Jesus tube out of the judiciary? I mean, this is wrong, obviously, but what do you think? 866-303-2270 is our number. It's we'll be talking about that for the next, you know, probably 15, 20 minutes, half hour, because this is important stuff to me, because I believe that that's what they want, a state religion.
Oh, yeah, that is what they want, and that is the first step down the long road toward fascism in this country, folks.
The F word.
Stay with us. This is Air America Radio.
Join the morning sedition.
Right now,
call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
34 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
I just had my job listing in front of me, and now I don't have it anymore. It was here, and now it's gone. So much for that. Here we go. Let's talk about it. Let's continue talking about Tom DeLay in terms of this is the judicial war on faith. Is this confronting the judicial war on faith? Is this this thing they're going to hold in April 7th and 8th in Washington, D.C.? And as you said, the speakers include Senator Sam Brownback, Senator Tom Coburn, former Vatican Ambassador Ray Flynn, Alan Keyes, Tony Perkins, Mike Ferris, Howard Phillips. A lot of these people, and the things that they're going to be addressing are the removal of Terry Schiavo's feeding tube, homosexual marriage, taking God out of the Pledge of Allegiance, bans on Ten Commandment monuments, abortion on demand, prohibiting school prayer. These are the people that really want to, make the judiciary branch of the government, answer, to religious fanaticism. That, they are insisting that this is not a government that should be, run by laws, and that the Constitution to these people is relatively meaningless. I see them as anti-American. I see them as treasonous, Mark Riley.
I see them attempting to establish a state religion. That is, a religious body or creed that is officially endorsed by government. And, by the way, that's not, the broad-based tent that is, in reality, Christianity. This is a specific type of Christianity. This is a specific set of rules that these folks want to impose on the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that is the worst part of what they're trying to do, because they're trying to abrogate religious freedom, by the way, under the false assumption that most Americans agree with them.
Well, they don't. And most Americans didn't agree with them in relation to the Terry Schiavo case, where most Americans thought it should have been, kept in the family, so to speak, and not have the state interfere with this process, with this very difficult decision-making process. Let's take a call. Sammy in South Carolina. Sammy?
Hey, Sammy.
Hey, how you guys doing?
All right, man.
Just wanted to call in. First of all, Mark and Mark, both of you guys are big fans. There's not much opposition for us down here in South Carolina. You guys are a real breath of fresh air, and we certainly appreciate it.
Well, sure. Thanks.
As far as and I saw your thing on HBO, and it was great. You guys, Mark, if you haven't seen it, I heard last week you did not watch it. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Well, I mean, you need to check it out, man. You like you're the rock that gives Mark the juice to flow. So, good thing.
Well, thank you for that, Sammy.
Yeah, man. Back to the I like the way y'all are hitting the anti-American thing, because I taught history for many years in high school, and people in South Carolina, if you tread on their religion, they're going to be upset. But if you show them that you're within the confines of the Constitution, you're going to win a lot of battles down here, because they don't want to be. The last thing they want to be is anti-American. So, keep pushing that home.
Thank you.
Oh, no, you're right. And see, and this is the important part. The imposition of a state religion is, by its very definition, anti-American. To have one religion that everyone must operate in lockstep to. And when we start talking about the whole issue of school prayers and abortion on demand and the Ten Commandments and gay marriage, what we're talking about is the imposition of a particular strain of religion. Not all Christians oppose gay marriage. We know that already.
Right.
Not all Christians want to see Ten Commandment monuments every time they turn around at a state building. We know that's true.
And the abortion on demand is something you just read from the flyer. That's their language. That's
That is their language. That is what they talk about here, that they are against abortion on demand. They are against the prohibitions regarding school prayer. And this is part and parcel of the baby steps that lead down the road, in my judgment, to fascism.
Right.
Eventually, we will get there if these people have their way.
Let's take a call from Aaron in Kentucky. Aaron, good morning.
Good morning, sirs. I'm glad you took my call. I'm listening to you on WCKY in Kentucky here. I'm a conservative. I'm just calling in to disagree with you, because I don't think that we're trying to establish a state religion. What I think we're trying to do is just have some type of code of ethics to go by, to make sure that the sanctity of life is protected, and that we operate under some type of moral code here in America.
But why does the code of ethics have to be a Christian code of ethics? We have a code of ethics. It's called the law of the land, and I don't understand why it needs to be Christian ethics or these specific ethics that are, you know, that are based on evangelical beliefs.
Well, when you follow the laws of our land back, you look at like the Sixth Commandment, which is thou shalt not kill.
Understandable.
We have a law that says you don't murder.
That's
we
right.
We also have a law that says, you know, perjury. You get 20 years if you commit perjury, which is basically lying. And that's also a commandment, which is the Ninth Commandment. You know, so we have our code of ethics that go back to the Judeo-Christian laws.
Well, okay, but now, wait a minute. Well, Sammy, let me ask you something now. Let's take that to its logical conclusion. There is also a commandment that says thou shalt have no other gods before me. How is that encoded in American law?
Well, I understand that there are certain commandments that aren't encoded in American law, and I understand that there is an argument. I'm not going to try to argue that that is something that's in our Constitution.
Yeah.
What I do think that we should do, and I don't think that there's a problem with, is if we have some type of laws that say, hey, you can't take the life of an unborn child.
Well, but that's
wrong.
Yeah, but you're using a language that is not used by everybody. You know, an unborn child is not necessarily the language that we use. You know, on some level, it's not a child at all. But you know, but getting back to what you were saying before, the laws that you're talking about, or the ethics you were talking about, actually pre-existed Judeo-Christian laws and ethics, and they came from, you know, even ancient, more distant texts than that. So the whole idea that it goes back to some Judeo-Christian root is not even in itself historically true. But thanks for your call, Aaron.
We appreciate it. Yeah, I called him Sammy. That was Aaron.
But the truth is that, you know, he getting back to this life thing, is that they define life in a very specific way, or what is the, you know, pre-life or what have you, and even that is not agreed upon. So he is still sort of pushing a Christian sort of evangelical you know, idea of ethics, which is not what the law of the land is supposed to be.
No, and you were right, though, about pointing out that many of these codes predate Judeo-Christian thought.
Yeah, of course. Elena in San Francisco, the Quake, how are you?
Good morning, Mark and Mark.
Hi, Elena.
I want to agree with you, Mark. I think that this is turning into a fascist country, and it's really frightening and sad. And these people are traitors. And as a matter of fact, all you Catholics mourning your Pope, these evangelicals think that you're left-wing liberals and will be out.
Mm. Isn't that interesting that they think the Catholics are left-wing liberals?
Yeah.
Yeah, compared to evangelicals. I mean, come on, fundamentalists of any stripe are frightening to me.
Absolutely.
But you know
I
what, Elena, one of the things that we saw in the Schiavo case was a meeting of the minds between evangelicals and Catholics. Remember, Terry Schiavo was, by all reports, a lapsed Catholic, and you saw Father Pavone and others speaking on behalf of the Schindler family. At the same time, you had evangelicals speaking on behalf of the Schindler family.
Go ahead, Elena.
That's true. They're not totally diametrically opposed. However, you did notice that the Pope chose to be able to have a dignified death.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting point.
Yeah, I don't think he had a choice, given the...
Yeah, he could have had all those tubes and monitors shoved in him. He chose not to go to the hospital.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
That's a good point.
Thank you very much for your call. It's interesting, because I saw the Catholics, like she was saying, I still think that the evangelicals are not comfortable with Catholics, even though they rip off some of their ideas. But I saw the Catholics coming into the Schiavo case and saying, you know, kind of going, come on, can we? I mean, we're kind of on the same page here. You know, it's just because we got a costume, you know. But anyway.
Evangelicals are not always comfortable with Catholics. They're not always comfortable with Jews. Remember that the Klan, who hated Catholics, by the way, projected themselves as a religious-based institution as well.
Well, I got to be honest with you. I'm Jewish, and I'm not always comfortable with Jews. But the...
Yeah, I know.
But when we come back, it looks like we've got a lawyer on the line who you know, wants to share his thoughts. You know, let me see if he'll if he'll hold on. You know, Brendan, we make sure he holds on. Okay, it's 43 past the hour. We'll be back in a second.
Join the morning sedition right now. Call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
48 past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yep.
It's Morning Sedition. It's Monday. We're going to land this thing. We're talking about a meeting of a group of traitors that are being headed off by Tom DeLay at a confronting the Judicial War on Faith conference in Washington, D.C. These anti-American, anti-constitutional traitors are trying to usurp the judiciary branch of the government by denying states' rights and also putting in, impeaching judges that honor the law of the land and putting in Republican religious activist judges, anti-Americans. First, let's do this job listing, and then we're going to take a call from a lawyer who's going to tell us about the judiciary. We know a lot of people out there looking for work, so we've gone through the want ads, and we found our Monday morning sedition job listing. Okay. U.S. state seeks new freak magnet. The state of Florida is looking for someone or something to fill a long-standing historic role in the state, someone to attract the national media and other freaks, some cause that makes us look like a bunch of damn morons, something to make people in backwoods and bayous all over the 49 states shake their heads in condescension. Do you have what it takes to further tarnish a state that is already a national laughingstock? This job actually might require very little effort. The last person to hold this position was an unfortunate bulimic who ended up forcing to live for over a decade, even though we knew she had cup of soup where her frontal lobe should have been. Prior occupants of the post include a Cuban child traumatized by watching his mother drown and playing with Diane Sawyer, and a Florida Secretary of State who had her makeup applied with a paintball gun. The only qualification is that ineffable quality that will draw fringe psychotics to descend upon you from throughout our state with crudely hand-lettered signs and distorted, tear-stained faces. Health coverage is negotiable, but major media coverage is guaranteed. Apply now. The sooner you start, the sooner we can begin a creepy candlelight vigil. There you go.
I like that. Health coverage is negotiable, but media coverage is guaranteed.
Exactly. All right, Brendan, in San Antonio, tell us why it's important to have an independent judiciary.
In Tocqueville's Democracy in America, he praises the genius of American democracy, and that is that Americans understand the absolute necessity of an independent judiciary. He writes that an independent legal profession is the key key bulwark against the excesses of democracy. And I sit here stunned as a lawyer and an American who knows my own country's history when I hear a guy like Alan Keyes suggest that the executive and the legislative branch have a constitutional obligation to disregard orders of the United States Supreme Court or a state Supreme Court because they disagree with that interpretation, because that goes against the very key check and balance that makes democracy work in this country.
Yeah, and right now the judiciary is the only thing, you know, holding that back.
It always has been. It always has been. And people who want to challenge that are people who want to destroy the Constitution.
Right.
Key check and balance.
These guys are anti-American, and Tom DeLay is facilitating that right from your own state.
And this is what it's for. This is what that check and balance is for. I'm going to give you an example from history.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys know of any instance where a sitting United States president openly and deliberately disregarded a United States Supreme Court opinion?
Tell us.
Andrew Jackson.
Okay.
Worcester versus Georgia was an opinion by Chief Justice John Marshall in around 1829, 1830, which determined that Indian tribes were sovereign nations, and therefore the Indian Removal Act passed by the Congress could not be applied to them.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be done through treaty.
Mm-hmm.
Jackson's response, and the background is that the Cherokees used to live in Georgia, and they had a lot of great land there that white settlers wanted to take from them.
Of course.
So they got the Congress to pass a law allowing them to be removed. So the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, you can't touch them. You don't have a law to do it that's valid, that satisfies our Constitution. Jackson's response was, Justice Marshall has made his decision. Now let's see him enforce it. He then ordered the U.S. military to forcibly remove the entire Cherokee Nation
from Georgia
to Oklahoma in what went down as one of the most embarrassing and tragic events in U.S. history, the Trail of Tears.
Right,
4,000 people died because there wasn't enough food, and the Cherokee people of Georgia were forced out of their homes and off their property so that the majority of white settlers who wanted the property in that area could simply just take it.
And they learned their lesson because less than a century later, they did the same thing to black people in Forsyth County, Georgia.
That's right, and they did the same thing to Japanese people in internment camps in World War II. The fact is that the judiciary and its independence to see those things for what they are, apart from the political process, is the only thing that keeps us from murdering one another.
Thank you so much for your call, Brendan. Powerful stuff. Appreciate it.
Unfortunately, that wasn't good enough in Foresight. They kind of succeeded.
Well, it's interesting how they meet the judiciary decision that some of these presidents, like someone like Jackson, just said, well, screw you, we're going in.
Yeah, we're going to do this anyway. And that's what they wanted George W. Bush to do. That's what they wanted Jeb Bush to do in terms of trying to take custody of Terry Schiavo. That's what they were essentially saying to the court, screw you, we're going to do it anyway.
Okay, let's take another call from Paul. Paul in New Jersey. How are you, Paul?
Hey, Paul.
Hey, Mark, how are you doing?
Good.
Mark and Mark.
All right.
Listen, I want to let you know real quickly, I used to work for an agent in the comedy business in New York named Roger Paul. I don't know if you remember
him. Sure, I know him.
But, yeah, well, that sounds like a real Roger.
I didn't do too many of his gigs, but I know him.
But I knew that you were brilliant a long time ago, and thank God now all of America is getting to know
that's very
how
nice.
Great you are, Mark. Listen, about the Christo-fascist neo, I'm sorry, I'm getting that wrong, but...
Zombie brigades.
They are, exactly. They are, not only are they traitors, but I'll tell you what, they're really not following Christian teaching in the process. If you'll remember, when the Jewish authorities confronted Jesus about whether they should pay taxes to the Roman Empire or if that was moral, he said quite clearly, pay unto the emperor what is the emperor's and pay unto God what is God's, which sounds an awful lot like separation of church and state to me.
Interesting.
I don't know if, you know, and this other guy who just called is talking about, you know, they make a big deal about the Ten Commandments and posting the Ten Commandments. Jesus also, you know, the early Christians thought that Jesus came to replace the law of the Ten Commandments, that it was through following him. Not the Ten Commandments, that you found salvation. So I'm not sure exactly what it is that they hope to accomplish with the Ten Commandments.
What they hope to accomplish is they want to take over the country.
Yeah, they do.
If I apologize for being long-winded, but one more thing. We have in
Northern Can't be too
Jersey,
long. Yeah.
Okay, we have a Tom DeLay clone here named Scott
Garrett. Scott Garrett, yep.
And he is holding a town hall meeting tonight in Dumont, New Jersey at 7 p.m. at the Dumont Borough Hall. And all of your listeners here, if they can get out there and start asking this guy some of these tough questions, I'm sure he's going to be attending this conference that you're talking about.
Okay.
And you know, let's make this guy answer some tough questions.
Okay, we'll try and make that happen, man. Thanks
that's
for
a good
calling,
point.
Paul.
Thanks a lot. Yeah.
Okay, that's in Dumont, New Jersey, at 7 o'clock.
Yeah, Scott Garrett. He replaced a moderate Republican. He was backed by that infamous Club for Growth.
Okay.
You
All
know,
right.
Yeah, the ones that backed the conservative Republicans against the moderate Republicans.
It's spreading in New Jersey. We've got to stop it. It's right over there.
Not far from my house.
There's the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Write these down. One, know that now that the Pope has died, make a list of every outrage, accusation, cutting comment, snide remark, and vicious slur you ever said about him. Save the list and send that, mail it to the next Pope. Two, April is National Anxiety Month. Until May 1st, go to your special place. Three, go to NCAA Finals. Protest Illinois Illini. Why did I say it wrong? I said it right the first
Illini.
Time. Illini for demeaning Native Americans. Figure out who the hell the North Carolina Tar Heels are demeaning so you can complain about that, too. Four, observe daylight savings time by reminding Republicans to set their clocks ahead to 2005. Five, today's phrase, drop this in the conversation. I don't know who the Cardinals of College counts the votes. I don't know how the College of Cardinals counts the votes for the next Pope, but if Diebold is involved, get ready for Pope Cheney the First. Wake up, sheeple. It's Ohio all over again. There you go. Again, hi, WANRAM 1570 in Youngstown, Ohio, and Progressive Talk 1270 in Davenport, Iowa. Welcome.
That's right. Now, tomorrow, think existentialism and consumerism. We're going to deal with them both right here on Air America Radio. Have a good one, Marin.
You too, Riley.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.